There are a million reasons to listen to Odeo, and this is one.
Good morning. You know when Tim does the kind of a now the sopranos come in and now the altos come in and all that? I'm sitting down there and I'm just waiting for him to say, now all the guys with voices like gravel, you come in now. Right? Hasn't happened yet. I haven't been able to sing half the time. I want to explain to you why you were initially kind of seated a bit differently, and I'm just going to explain to you why you're initially sitting. What happened to my platform? Did it get smaller? Too much walking around. You get into trouble, they take your platform away. We had originally kind of figured that we might get you kind of, some of you sitting around the opposite way to the way you'd expected, and we were going to try and split you up a little bit, you know, have a criteria for who sits up there and back here and what have you. And the idea being just to kind of get you, you know, out of the box and get you out of thinking like, well, hang on, I've been sitting here all week. And you imagine what it's like if that's your spot all week. And then you imagine what it's like if that's your church and you've been going there for 40 years. You know, you can understand how we can kind of get sunk into kind of ruts, even in just 5 days. And so we kind of want to do something that would kind of get you kind of a little exasperated, a bit annoyed, and just a bit like, well, what are we doing this for? And I can't see anything. And so I don't know if that kind of worked for you, but it's kind of a bit of a theme for us. We just kind of sort of make you feel uncomfortable this week. And, you know, usually, I mean, learning is not done by simply listening to people give you lectures. Learning is done when you're annoyed and angry and upset and at the end of your tether and you're not sure if you agree or disagree. That's when learning really happens, because you're out there on the edge and you're thinking, do I buy this or not? And so just sitting on your bots and listening to me kind of pour stuff, vomit forth stuff over you like that, is it the best way to learn, or can we do some stuff to kind of get you thinking, what's that all about? So that's where we were going with that. I'd like to say a prayer, and then I'd like to build on some of the stuff I was saying for you yesterday. And I also have to make a note to make sure I get more platform tomorrow. I feel terribly frustrated. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for just the extraordinary wealth of creativity and energy, gifts, talents, experience, insight, wisdom that is accumulated in this room. Stuff I, Father, couldn't even begin to fathom or imagine, Lord. And yet, Father, I sometimes imagine you looking out at a group of people just like this and knowing of what you've poured into each and every one of them, what each individually can do for the extension of your kingdom, what collectively we can do, Father, that you understand all that unrealized potential, that you recognize the enormous gift and experience that is represented in this one room alone, let alone in your church worldwide, Father. Lord, I pray that we might have some insight, some way of knowing what you know about us, so that we might, Father, grow individually and collectively to become the people that you intended us to be in the first place. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Now, yesterday I was talking to you, you probably heard some of this stuff before, but I was talking to you about the way we can see things kind of either dualistically or holistically. Either we can see the world split in two between the material and the spiritual, the religious and the non-religious, and we can divvy up our world and create zones where God operates and then just presume that God's kind of passive or not operating in those other zones. Or we can think much more like the Jews did, much more like the greatest Jew did, our friend Jesus did, and that is to look at the world much more holistically and see that God doesn't occupy certain zones or spaces, but God's grace is everywhere. If we have the creativity and the mind and the spirit and the eyes to look for it and to see the ways in which God has been revealing himself. And one of the things I said to you yesterday was, if you have a dualistic worldview, if you're looking at those two zones, well, primarily you end up going down the road of imagining that all your mission, all your evangelism, all your outreach work to our neighbours and friends is basically about creating a God zone, church, youth group, outreach, evangelism event, you name it, creating a God zone, and then we go out from that zone, we share our faith with our friends in some way, and then we bring them back into that zone where they can meet God. Now, I know that's not all the churches do, but that is our primary strategy. It's about creating a space where people can meet God. not assuming that our friends out here have God hanging around, whispering, cajoling, bullying, tripping them up all over the place to try and get them to be aware of him. We assume nothing happens out here until we bring them back into the space where they can meet God. And I think I mentioned yesterday to you, if all your eggs or most of your eggs are in that basket, well, we realise just how irrelevant we're becoming, don't we? Because by and large, people aren't wanting to come to our churches. I talked about Burning Man Festival. I could talk about Mind, Body, Spirit festivals. I could talk about all sorts of kind of religious, spiritual communities that are developing around the Western world, around this country, around Sydney. There are lots of other options. We're not the only option. We're just one of the options on the buffet of spiritual kind of searching. And so this whole notion, if it's all about getting them to come back and hear from God, those who are interested already have, and those who aren't, ain't coming. Have you got friends, a brother, a sister, your mum, your dad, your aunt, or someone who you really love that you've invited to church a zillion times? And they came once or twice to shut you up and keep you happy, but they ain't coming back again, are they? It's like they had their little taste of it, they kept you happy, you've asked them enough, they're not going to come back again. So if all our eggs are in that basket, well, what do we say to those people? Well, if you don't like church, or you're not interested in our particular Christian group, if you don't want to buy that, well, there's no other way for you to meet God. I don't personally want to go down that line. I don't want us to see that that is the chief or primary way we get people to meet Jesus. We go out of our spiritual zone into the world and we grab someone back in order to meet God. A much more holistic view is, as I mentioned yesterday, the view that we find in Jesus, who's able to say, here we are now playing with our kids. Here we are walking through a field looking at lilies. Here we are, you know, having a yak to a bunch of Roman centurions. Here we are when someone's kid has died. Here we are where blah, blah, blah. And I can see God in this experience, and I can introduce you to the God that has been hanging around you all your life that you never even knew. Now, when you start to think of that more holistic sense about God and God's involvement in this planet, don't mishear me, we do like to meet, and we will create worship zones, and there will be places where we collectively feel God's presence more than, say, we do at university or work. But that doesn't mean God's more present here and less there. It just means we're more keenly aware of it in certain places than at other places. Does that make sense to you? A more holistic approach is to say, yeah, okay, there's a particular tree I go and pray under and I really sense God's presence there, but I don't think God lives under that tree. There's a church service I go to at my church and I'm really pumped at the end of it. I just really feel like I'm met with God, but I don't think God lives in that place. God is here, here, here. God is, grace is everywhere. When we start to think like that, then we start to realise that impacting our culture is not about grabbing them, kidnapping them back into sacred zones. Rather, it's about going out into our world with a much more robust, confident spirituality, a confident Christianity that says, I can see Jesus in this dance class. I can see Jesus in this workplace. I can see Jesus in this film or at this cricket match, so on and so forth. So you're plugging people in to the God who is there, not the God who is over there. Now, what I'd like to do for you today is to say, well, if we're going to embrace this much more holistic approach of thinking about God being everywhere and grace being everywhere, we're much more concerned about not getting people to come to us, but we're now thinking about mission in terms of us going to them, what kind of framework, what does the Bible tell us we ought to live like or look like if we're going to do that? And just before I get to that, I need to say what I'm basically setting up for you is this. The difference between these two approaches to mission or evangelism. One is called attractional and the other is called incarnational. Attractional is create a God zone and try to get people to go there. I think I mentioned at the last Coomera, I always find it hilarious to imagine that, you know, there's people who don't go to your church, don't want to go to your church, but you're thinking that because we now got rid of pews and put in plastic seating, and we're playing pop music instead of kind of grand classical hymns, down at the local boozer they're all going to be saying, man, we ought to get along to that church. You know, we're tinkering with this attractional zone here. We're changing all we can. Let's add some drama. Let's add some this. Let's do that. Let's try the other thing. Let's change this music. Let's get the lighting to do that. The fact of the matter is it doesn't matter what you do in there. They don't want to come. Have you worked that out? It's not like they're going to go, ooh, ah, you got flag waving in your church? I'm coming. If flag waving enriches you, if flag waving is some way in which you feel kind of taken up greater into the presence of God, do it. But they're not going to come running to get it. Do you follow what I'm saying? It's an attractional zone. Create the zone and try and draw them into our orbit. Yet what we're discovering is they're not coming any longer. The opposite of that Now that's the dualistic way of looking at it. The opposite of that is called incarnational. Just what God did for us. God wanted to reach us with the kingdom, to bring the gospel effectively to us. What did he do? Sweep us all up into heaven? We would have all been converted, wouldn't we? Oh, well, let's bring them to us. Let's get attractional. Bring them all into... No, what he decides to do is he comes to us and becomes one of us. That theologically is called the incarnation. God in human form. So that when we seek to follow in Christ's footsteps, to be incarnational, what we're saying is we're going to leave so-called sacred zones. This is the way we love to do it. We're going to keep doing it that way for us. But when we want to impact our culture, we're going to leave that zone and we're going to become a surfer to reach surfers. We're going to become a dancer to reach dancers. We're going to become a businessman to reach business people, whatever the case may be. Where do they go? What do they do? We'll go there in order to reach them because we believe God is at the beach. God is in the dance studio. God is in the business. Where do business people go? The restaurant. Incarnation means we go as God came to us. Now, I tell you what, I teach this kind of stuff at the college that I teach at, and initially people's eyes light up. Wow, that's great. So we can go to the pub and we can say to our church, sorry, I can't go to church, I need to be where Jesus would be, you know. I'm going to go to the beach this Sunday because that's where Jesus would be. Well now, I do believe that's probably where Jesus would be. He would be in the pub, he would be at the beach, he would be at wherever your particular community likes to go. But what would he be doing there is the question I've got for you. Like, he's not just kicking back at the beach, is he? He's not just having a few beers on a Sunday night rather than going to that boring old church. What is he doing there? If you're going to follow in his footsteps, sure, go to the pub if that's where they hang in your particular area. Go to the beach, go to the club. You go where they go, but what would Jesus do while he was there? What was he doing? Loving people, healing people, transforming people. Did you follow what I'm saying? So in fact, it is the more difficult option. I remember one student, our college is more or less across the road from a pub, which I think is very convenient for the people in the pub. And I had one student say to me, oh, you know, sorry, I missed your class last night, I was up the pub and one thing led to another. But, you know, Frosty, after all, it's what you teach. I mean, that's where Jesus would be, right? I said, mate, you listen to me. If you go to the pub because it's the lazy option, it's the easy option, it's the kind of the lowest common denominator option, that's not what Jesus would do. If you go there, well, don't miss my classes because Jesus wouldn't do that. But if you go there, but if you go there because you're going there like Jesus would go there, you go there because you're looking for pain or suffering or need or hurt. You are going there to be a healing influence in that kind of context. Does that all make sense to you? So the attractional thing is easy. The attractional thing, much as you might think it's hard, it is easier to try and tinker with what happens in the space and try to get people. I mean, it's not easy to get them there. It's easy for you to create that space. What is more difficult is for you to say, oh, hang it. Let's just worship the way we want to worship. And let's do worship in a way which mobilizes us and unleashes us to go where God has sent us to be Jesus in that context. And that is bloody hard. That is nothing but hard work and sacrifice, which is what he said to us, isn't it? You want to follow me? You've got to take up your cross. What was that all about? Not looking at dirty magazines and not getting drunk? No, that was all about every fibre of your being given over to serving the community to which you believe God has given you. That is thinking of others first. Giving yourself over for us. What was the incarnation? God came to us to reach us and emptied himself in order that we might be transformed. What is incarnational mission? It is leaving your zone and emptying yourself into the place where you are likely to meet people and encounter them. Now, incarnational mission is jolly hard. And what I want to do for you this morning is run through a number of the things that the New Testament tells us incarnational people or incarnational communities do. If you are serious about individually abandoning this dualism, abandoning this sacred zone kind of thing, this attractional approach, if you want to see it doesn't work and besides it's not biblical anyway, you want to leave that aside, you want to become a New Testament Christian, a kind of wild, untamed follower of Jesus and embrace this incarnational approach, I don't want you to go out on your own. I want you to know that there are certain requirements that are expected of incarnational Christian people. Does that all make sense to you? So those things are these. If you've got, there's like six or seven of them. Don't quote me about this. There could be 10 or 11 of them, but you know, there's a bunch of them. So if you're going to make notes, because I want you to get this kind of stuff so you know these things to which you have been called. The first thing is this. If we are going to be incarnational people with a holistic understanding of our spirituality, we firstly have to embrace holy or godly living as an evangelistic or missional end in itself. Now the church was really big on holy living, not drinking, not smoking, not dancing. Very big on kind of not looking like the world out there, not going to the movies on Sunday, not working on Sunday, not playing sport on Sunday. You know that old kind of approach, some of you look far too young to know about this, but that old kind of approach where we would be holy, holy and clean and pure. We're not polluted by alcohol or by cigarettes or by dancing or wearing makeup. Or actually, one of the funny things about this was I grew up a Catholic, and when I first started going to a Baptist church, my dear old mum said to me, What are you hanging around with the Baptists for? They don't drink, they don't smoke, they don't have sex before they're married. And I thought, Mum, you're warning me off these people? Like, but this holiness idea was that, you know, we will look really pure, we'll look really different from the rest of the world, and everyone will be attracted to us by how different we look. Well, what has happened in this country? What has all that holy living done for the church in Australia? I mean, people look at our so-called holiness, and are they attracted? Are they saying, oh, I love fundamentalist Christians. Oh, I love that they don't smile, they don't wear makeup. I want to be part of something like that. I remember years ago, the Church of Christ asked me to speak at their national conference, and they said, could you tell us what non-Christians think of the church? I don't know why I'm the expert on that, but I remember talking to a bunch of young guys, and I said to them, listen, I've got to do this talk on what non-Christians think of the church. So tell me, you know, what do you think about church people? Can you imagine what they said? Non-Christian, unchurched, good guys, fine upstanding blokes, but, you know, what do you think of the church? Do you think they said, the church? Oh man, the church is the soul of the earth. The church is goodness in a sea of deceit and evil. The church is the one light that continues to flame in the midst of darkness and horror. The church, they're good, they're generous, they're loving, they're hospitable. Those are pure, solid gold people. The church, I love those people. You reckon? What do you think they said? Church, well, they said some words that come to mind. Judgmental, condescending, bigoted, up themselves, sanctimonious. Not you, Mike, just all the other ones, you know. Like. Why does our culture think that we are a bunch of self-righteous, sanctimonious so-and-sos? Why? I know lots of Christians who aren't like that. Why do they think that way? Because we have a heritage of saying holy living is about looking down on people as being less clean than us. Now, when you read about it in the New Testament, holiness does not mean that we look better than everyone else. Holiness is not about us separating ourselves away from people. Holiness is not designed to separate us and create some kind of gulf between us and our world. If we are going to live holy lives, says the New Testament, you should live such lives that people are dying to be part of what you have. If you have your Bibles, I want you to turn to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew 5:13 says this, you are the salt, Jesus is talking to his followers. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. You are the light of the world, he says to the church. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds and what? Praise your Father in heaven. In other words, holiness, godly living, is not designed to make people think that they're dirtier than you, that you're better than them, or that you're bigoted or sanctimonious or something like that. Your holy lives are supposed to be so delicious that people say, what is going on with those people? They have got something that we have not got. So we are not defined by whether we drink or smoke or dance or do this or that on Sunday. We are defined by how generous we are. Follow? by how hospitable we are, how caring we are, how compassionate we are. They ought to look at us and they ought to say, all right, I don't know whether I want to buy this, whether I want to join them or not, but I've got to hand it to them. Those people love like there's no tomorrow. Holy living is supposed to be attractive. It's supposed to have people say, what have they got? What makes them different from us? Yet by and large, when they look at the church, what do they see? But division and hatred and spite. Well, when they look at Northern Ireland and they look at denominational carry-ons in various parts of the world, they think to themselves, these Christians can't even love each other. Well, what is this? Is there something attractive about this to us? We ought to be ashamed. Do you feel ashamed? We ought to say, oh God, I wish I could wipe out 2,000 years of church history. Not that there haven't been great stuff that the church has done, but I wish we could go back and erase everyone's memory of all the wicked and vile things we Christians have done to each other and start again as this radical experiment of love and faith and hope and justice. They look at Sydney Anglicans saying this about someone else. Pentecostals say that about somebody else. Blah, 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 blah. They think we're just a bunch of cranky, whiny old so-and-sos. And guess what? We give them enough evidence to think so, don't we? Turn to Titus chapter 2. Paul is speaking to Titus, who's a leader of the church, and he gives Titus a whole bunch of rules and regs, basically. I want you Christians to live like this. Now I'm going to read through some of those, and just follow it. It's Titus chapter 2. Find Hebrews and go back a little bit. Tiny little book. I'm sorry to pick the little ones, but try and find Titus chapter 2. Now here's Paul talking to Titus. He says, you must teach what is accord with sound doctrine. Teach older men to be temperate, worthy of respect and self-controlled, sound in faith, in love and endurance. Likewise, teach the older women to be reverent in the way they live, not to be slanderous or addicted to too much wine, but teach what is good. Then they can train the younger women to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled, but pure, to be busy at home, to be kind, to be subject to their husbands, so that no one will malign the word of God. Similarly, encourage the young men to be self-controlled. In everything, set them an example by doing what is good. In your teaching, show integrity, seriousness, and soundness of speech that cannot be condemned, so that those who oppose you may be ashamed because they have nothing bad to say about you. Then he goes on to slaves. Teach slaves to be subject to their masters and everything, and to try to please them, not to talk back to them, not to steal from them, but to show that they can be fully trusted, so that in every way they will make the teaching about God, our Saviour, attractive. Now, a lot of those rules are kind of designed for culture at that time. Our culture and family arrangements have changed somewhat, but what he's basically saying is, I want you all to be the most extraordinary, kind, loving, giving, compassionate people, slaves, young women, old women, young men, you, the works, all of you. I want you to be such extraordinary people so that what? The final verse, verse 10, so that you will make the teaching about God our Saviour attractive. So they will see you and they will say, what makes them who they are? What makes them look the way they look? So holy living, godly living is a missionary activity. It's not something we just do for ourselves. We do it so people might see it. We ought to be the most loving, most compassionate, most giving people in the world. The number of churches I go to, where 2% of the offering goes to mission. Most of it just goes to serve whatever we happen to be doing. Tom Sine said this, let's face it, we even tithe to ourselves. We give our 10% and we spend it on us. We should be the most generous, the most depleted, the most giving of all people. That, my friends, transforms people's lives. Don't you agree? We are just surrounded by people who think primarily, or if not totally, about themselves. But there will be one standout community in our culture. One group of people who will look unlike anyone else. And it will be us. Those of us who decide we will leave our space, go and live in the world, go out there where all the despicable people are, and we will be like light, like salt, and people will say at the very least, by God, what have these people got? And they will have said the truth. We have it by God. The second thing I want you to be involved in, holy living is a missionary activity. The second thing I want you to recognize is that we need to be a praying community. The New Testament says that we have, when it comes to mission and impacting our culture, there are three things that we have to pray about. Whether you like it or not, you have to pray for them. We're told to, commanded to pray for these three things. So when you pray, you can pray for the sick people in your church. You can pray that so-and-so gets a job. You can pray that the weather's nice for the Sunday school picnic. That's fine. You can pray for those things. But you better also pray for these three things as well. The first thing you are called to pray for is that God would raise up in your midst more evangelists and missionaries. And when was the last time your church did that? Hopefully some of your churches are doing it. But I want you to get on your knees as a church and say, oh God, would you raise up in our midst, in our church, more evangelists to impact our culture? Now I need to explain to you what an evangelist is before you kind of write this stuff down. An evangelist is not necessarily Billy Graham who stands on a platform and preaches to zillions of people and they all get saved. He is an evangelist and a great one, but that is not the only model of an evangelist that there is. An evangelist is somebody who so naturally and normally secretes the gospel wherever they go that people's lives are transformed by their presence. They may not necessarily be preachers. They may not necessarily be great, articulate presenters. They may not be people you ever even want to get on a platform. But do you know those people can walk into a pizza place late at night and before you know it, they're just talking about God and Jesus and faith and the gospel with the bloke behind the counter? You know these kind of people? It's not like work. It's not like they did some course and worked out all the clever things to say. It just seeps out of them. There are people like that in your church. I will promise you that because you are promised that there will be evangelists in your church as well as a number of other things. They are sitting there in your church. You know why I know they're there? Because I'm an evangelist too. And I go to your church and I preach in your church. I might go and preach evangelistically in your church. And some people might get converted, some people might want to talk to me about Jesus afterwards. But usually the people who hang around right at the very end, they're flicking the lights on and off, telling us to get out of here. Usually we have the conversation in the car park afterwards, are the evangelists. Then the guys and the girls who hang around, they say, I'm an evangelist too. Really, I say, well, how do you know that? I don't know. I got to pick my kids up at the school gate at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I don't know, just Jesus comes out. I don't know, I'm in my workplace, everyone knows and they're all open, they come to me with their problems, we talk, I don't know, it just comes out of me. Do you know those kind of people? I've got to tell you here and now, I've met so many of them, I know most of them are kooks. Most of them have real traumas in their life. They're not clean, neat, tidy, middle class, square-shouldered, square-jawed kind of Southern Baptist preachers. They've been divorced. They've been sexually abused. Not all of them, but some of them have been betrayed. But they are in your church. God put them there because the gospel just seeps out of them. What you need to be doing is praying that God would raise up more of them because you know what they do for you? They keep you sharp. They keep you on the edge and they keep you always thinking that we exist for the community in which we live, not for ourselves. They don't let you get away with just doing stuff for us. They're a pain in the neck. Every meeting when you want to buy a new this or that, they're saying, why don't we give it to the poor? Why don't we run this program to reach people? Why don't we start this? Why don't we get a soup kitchen going? They are the ones who won't let you spend money on yourself. They're the ones who are always looking. What's out there? What can we do? How can we serve this? They're the ones who are always pushing you out. Well, my friends, they're there. Churches try to silence them because we've got this love affair going on at the moment with pastors and teachers. Pastors and teachers are great. And God, they're a gift to our church as well. But why do they get all the say? Let's get some prophets and apostles and evangelists up here. Do you follow? Let's get some people who kind of crack open the centre and push us out beyond the place where we find ourselves. That's no disrespect intended to pastors and teachers. That is a godly gift to us. Use them. Learn from them. But they're not the only font of knowledge or insight in our churches. Do you follow? When you go back home, don't tell your pastor that I said that. And for those of you who are pastors, I honour you, God bless you. But would you let someone else have a say for a change? So you're called to raise evangelists up. So you start praying. A good thing to do, now this is just a little tip, take it for what it's worth, but a good thing to do is that when God starts to raise them up or bring them in from wherever, a good thing to do is to recognise them, acknowledge them. You want to say, John here, We've tested his gift. We've seen the impact that he has. He's an evangelist. We're not going to get him to preach on Sundays. We're not going to get him to be the head of the evangelism committee. You know what we're going to do? We're going to unleash him to exercise his gift. And I reckon he ought to be invited to every party, every dinner, every event that is happening in your church. The evangelists ought to be totally immersed in the culture of your friends and your social connections. Unleash them. set them free so that they might do the work that God has called them to do. Have a look, we won't read it, but have a look at Matthew 9, 36 to 38, where Jesus says, pray that the Lord of the harvest would raise up more harvesters, more missionaries, more evangelists. The only time that's ever preached in your church, I bet, is when we are sending missionaries out overseas. And so it should be. But there's no reason why we oughtn't to be raising up harvesters for our church here as well as for the church overseas. Mission is mission. Happens in your own backyard or across the other side of the planet. It's the same stuff. The second thing you're called to pray for is for the success of these evangelists. That's Ephesians 6:19. So you pray for their blessing, for their protection. Pray that they would maintain their commitment to Christ and that they would be blessed in the success of their ministry. And then the third thing that you're called to pray for is you are called to pray for your unsaved friends and neighbours. You're just called to take their names before Jesus. Lord, we pray for our community here at Cooma. That's okay. But what I want you to do is say, Lord, I pray for John and Frank and Nathan and Sarah and Hannah. Name them. Love them. Focus on them and recognise that you are God's gift to them even though they may not know it. Now, do you all follow? I want you to become a holy community that lives radically different to the society around you. I want you to get on your knees and pray like crazy. We spend far too much time planning what happens on platforms and not enough time praying that God would raise up harvesters and would gift us to the community around us. Third thing that I want us to do is that we are called to socialise with as many unbelievers as we possibly can. You didn't know that that was in the Bible, did you? You thought that this was in the Bible. Come ye out and be ye separate! You get plenty of that in church, don't you? Don't be defiled by the evil one! Now, that might have worked when, you know, when the people of God were wandering around the desert and easily kind of seduced by the different religions around. But my friends, Jesus has come and died and been resurrected. We are free. You follow? Come ye out and be ye separate. That's going to really impact our culture, isn't it? What we are called to do is to go forth as missionaries. And there is, in fact, a call for us to socialise thoroughly with our non-Christian friends. Have a look at 1 Corinthians. I won't get us to read it now, but you're probably familiar with this particular text. Have a look at 1 Corinthians chapters 5 and 10. I'll let you do that in your own time. But in 1 Corinthians chapters 5 and 10... we've got a particular issue happening in the Corinthian church. This was the very, very important issue of whether you could eat meat offered to idols. Now, I struggle with that one all the time. How about you? You think to yourself, can we just delete that from the Bible? Is this the least bit relevant? But it is. Listen to what's going on. This is the way it worked in Corinth. People would take an animal to a pagan altar, an evil non-god, a pagan god, and they would slaughter this animal as an act of devotion to this pagan god. And then what are they going to do with this meat? I mean, what, burn it all? No. What they would do is they would then take the slaughtered animal to the butcher. Butcher would carve it up and they'd sell it. So that you're eating meat that had previously been offered over to some evil god. They're not really gods, you're aware of that, into some non-god. And so the Christians thought, oh, this is tantalised, not tantalised, I can get by on my own, thank you. Well, I do appreciate your help. This is, what word was I looking for? Tainted, yes, tainted. But this is tainted meat. There's evil, there's spirits in it, there's vile, just the gods have infected this. If we eat this, do we eat the kind of, the paganism into us? Is it kind of, come on. Transferable. And so this is a big deal for them. Can we eat this? That are we supporting the pagan industry? I mean, you know, all sorts of questions like that. And so Paul actually takes it very, very seriously and talks about weaker brothers and stronger brothers and a whole sort of thing. But the bottom line for Paul is, if you don't eat meat offered to idols, what are the implications for that socially? It means that you can never eat at the table of a non-Christian. A non-Christian is going to serve you meat from the butcher store, right? So if I can't let that meat touch my lips, That means I can't sit down and eat at the table of my neighbour or my friend or my business associate because I know that that meat is defiled. So for Paul, this was not primarily a theological issue. Can evil spirits get into meat? Paul is not primarily concerned about that theologically. You know what he's really concerned about? He's concerned about the missional question. And the missional question is, can I eat with unbelievers? Can you drink with unbelievers? Can you be at certain parties with unbelievers when certain things are going on? That is the question. And Paul's answer is, if it comes to that, you will be strong enough to eat meat. Don't separate yourself from people who don't share your faith. That food cannot hurt you. Eat with them in the hope that you might be Christ at their table. Does that make sense to you? You are called to go out there and do it now. You might make a conscience call that at sometimes certain parties you need to leave. Certain events you just can't be party to. And that will be a call that you will make. But your primary motivation will be to stay as long as I can. Your primary motivation will be to be in close proximity with people that don't share my faith. If you decide I'm never ever going to hang out with these people again because they get drunk every Saturday night, well, what we're basically saying is there can be no Jesus presence with those people anymore. Now, when you do it, I think you need mentors and coaches and friends around you to keep you safe, to keep you strong, to pray for you. You need to go back to them and say, I did this, I said that, you know, check it out. Maybe you fell, maybe you compromised a bit, but so what? Keep going. There's no condemnation. Okay, you'll fall, but keep going. Do you follow what I'm saying? I'm not saying embrace debauchery for Jesus' sake. What I'm saying is be with debaucherous people for Jesus' sake. And get resources around you that keep you clean and keep you holy and keep you like a light in those kinds of contexts. This happens to me regularly. I preach evangelistically an event. They get some person to give their testimony and they say, before I was a Christian, you know, I used to drink all the time, I used to go out with my mates. You wouldn't believe the kinds of things. But now I'm a Christian. I found this new community. I love them. They love me. I've stopped going to the pub. I've stopped. And my heart breaks. I think, I wish you didn't stop going to that. Been part of that cricket team or that soccer team. I wish you didn't leave that non-Christian art studio or dance studio to go to these Christian ones. I wish you didn't leave the public school sector to go and teach in the private school Christian sector. I wish that you saw yourself as missional in the place that you are. It's only attractional, dualistic thinking that tries to suck people out and keep them safe here in the sacred zones. Now, I need to make a point to those of you who are pastors or leaders on staff in churches. Primarily, what we discover is that the more committed we get to Jesus, the more involved we get in the church, the less social contact we have with people who don't share our faith. Now, I speak at lots of clergy conferences, and I'll tell you, the number of pastors that say to me, I haven't got a single non-Christian friend. I'm not proud of that fact, they say, I just don't have any. And you know why they don't have any? Not because they're shy or antisocial or they've got some bizarre thing about I hate non-Christians. You know why? Because the wheels of church crank faster and faster and faster the more you're committed you get to it. So those of you who find yourself moving into leadership, you find you have less and less time for your old friends. Is that right? You find that you're out 3 or 4 nights a week, church on the weekends, and in the end you realise any spare time, I'm going to give it, if I've got one, to my family. I mean, I can't begin to. That's what church does to us. That's what this attractional church, this dualistic church does. It creates an environment that draws people into the centre, where a more holistic incarnational approach blows people out to the edges. And so what you should be saying to your pastor is, I don't expect you to visit me, run this, run that, be on this committee, that committee, or the other committee. Get out of here. If I hear pastor's not here this week, he's gone fishing with a bunch of mates, I'll go, woohoo! Well, he's going to be here most of the time, but occasionally he's going to go fishing. But you know what our churches do? They go, well, don't we pay him? You know, like, what's he doing? Oh, he's got all week off, and then he goes fishing on weekends. Well, so those of you who aren't in leadership, you just stick it to your pastor. Just say, hey, pastor, I haven't heard that you've been away for a while. Now, what clubs do you belong to? What hobbies do you have? Get them out. We are called to socialise with unbelievers. You ought to be at every dinner party. You ought to be the life of the party. You ought to be Jesus in that mix. You know, the thing that they said about Jesus, they couldn't get him on being a heretic. If they could have, they would have charged him with that. They couldn't get him for being a dissenter. They couldn't get him for being a revolutionary. You know what they charged him with more often than not? That he was a drunkard and a glutton. They must have had some evidence for that. I'm not saying he was either of those, but he must have drunk and eaten with all the wrong people. Well, maybe we can get him on that. I don't think he was a drunkard. I don't think he was a glutton, but I think he knew how to eat and drink with the best of them. Or should I say, the worst of them. Do you follow? As a little aside, don't you think it's cute that when Jesus gave us something to remember him by, he asked us to do what? And what do? We turn into little cubes of bread and little tiny... Eat and drink. Mate, I mean, I come from Sydney. I know you don't all come from Sydney. But if you come from Melbourne, you know this even more. We eat and drink, right? Like, is the whole city just exists so that we can eat and drink? We've discovered eating and drinking. Melbourne's been eating and drinking for ages. And look at them. We're trying to get like that as much as we can. See, we're talking about a culture that loves to eat and drink. People actually search for meaning around tables. One of the corny and funny little things I like is the way we think, right, people like to discover meaning over food. They like to eat and drink. They like to get a glass of red wine or a coffee, and they like to chew the fat with someone, really get into something. There's book clubs happening in cafes and restaurants all over the place. People want to search for meaning around tables, around food, interacting with each other. And so what we'll do is we'll start a cafe in church on Sunday night. Do you get it? You've kind of done half the work. Yeah, that's where they like to be. So why don't we create one of those over here in our safe, sacred space and get them to come to us. Far better you dismantle some of this and all of you go and hang in the same cafe 4 or 5 times a week. Would you make relationships? Would you build some friendships? Would you be part of some interactive conversations? Do you follow what I'm saying? If you do, you're a scary bunch of people. A couple more things. I want you to be about resourcing evangelism. If those of you who've got a few extra bucks, I want you to throw it into the pot in order to resource evangelism. If you discover that there's an evangelist God has gifted in your midst and you want to set him or her free so that they can go to dinner parties and go to parties and hang out and go on fishing trips, well, how are they going to get all this time? We'll release them from a bit of work a day a week and a few of you throw some money his way. Do you follow what I'm saying? Don't put your money behind putting some billboard out the front of our church. Don't put your money behind this idea that if we just extend our building, more people will come. Put your money behind unleashing people. Now, some of you have the gift of making money. Because I'm an evangelist, I go and preach in churches, and I told you all the evangelists want to talk to me, and often the rich guys want to talk to me too. Guys come to you with checkbooks open. Do you support yourself? Can I write you a check for your ministry? No, I say, I've got a salary, I work, I've got a job. No, let me write you a check. I want to give you some money. No, I don't need any money. Like, I've got a job. Give it to someone who needs some money. No, I want to give you some money. I want to support you. I said, well, you could take it out of your bank account and put it in my bank account, but how is that extending the kingdom in any way? Go and give it to someone else. And you know what they say to me? They say, listen, I've prayed to be able to preach like you preach. I would love to be able to stand up and tell people about Jesus the way you do. But I stand up, I can't get 2 words out of them. All I can do, I just got this curse. All I can do is just make lots of money. That's all I can do. Now I turn my hand to this and it just booms, you know. I turn my hand to that. More money, you know. So if I give you my money, I feel like I'm kind of preaching through you. It's a nice image, isn't it? No, I don't need their money. I direct them to missionaries and evangelists they can give their money to. But what I want you to do is to unleash some people. Maybe there's a single mum in your church who's the gifted evangelist, but she's got to move up the coast or out here or there in order to make ends meet. Why don't a bunch of us give her enough dough for a day, a week or something if we can keep her here? Did you hear what I'm saying? Unleash it. Resource it. Spend it. It's not yours anyway. You can't take it anywhere. Unleash it for the sake of the kingdom. Now I want you to follow this kind of thinking. If we start to live like this, if we start to stop putting our eggs into this attractional basket and get people to come to us, if we blow it open and we all move out to where our community happens to be, and if we're praying for them like crazy, socialising, living holy lives, worshipping in order to do mission, something interesting starts to happen. I actually remember Paul Coleman telling me this a while ago. We had a breakfast in a cafe in St Kilda, and he said, look, I'm no theologian, he said, but tell me if I got this all wrong. He said, Jesus told his mates that they were to be fishers of people, right? I said, yeah, that's right, because they were fishermen. He said, that's right, they were fishermen, so that when Jesus said to him, I want you to be fishermen for people, they would have kind of got that because they understood all about fishing. He said, I got to thinking about fishing. He said, when we fish, we think, like, we go out and we cast out one rod, one reel, one line, one hook, one bit of bait. We throw it out there. That's us versus that one fish. And we've got to kind of snag that thing. We've got to make sure the way the tides are running and the weather and what fish is where. And it's all Rex Hunt kind of mano a mano. Me versus that genius fish down there. He said, so that when we hear Jesus saying to us, we're to be fishers of people, we often think of it like that, me and him. I've got to get him, I've got to get her, I've got to tell her about you, I've got to get her, got her, and I've got to take her back to my church. He said, but when I was thinking about the way Jesus' disciples would have heard that, who were fishermen, you're going to be fishers of people. They didn't fish with one rod and one reel. When they fished, how do they fish? With nets. So, you know, they spend like 5-10% of their time actually out there fishing. They throw these nets out here, it's like they dredge this sea. Like, anything that's in there is going to get caught in that net. It's not real clever. It's not rocket science. Which is why, you know, that story where Peter says to Jesus, oh Lord, you know, we've fished, there's nothing out there. You know what he's saying? The nets have dredged that sea, mate. If there's something out there, it would have been in the nets. And Jesus says, cast the nets over the other side. You know this story? And there's more fish than they can pull up. It's astonishing. It's not like all the fish were hiding over here and we were fishing over there. Oh, of course the fish are over here. It's like we know for a fact there's no fish in there, and all of a sudden there are fish in there, which is why Peter goes, get away from me. Like, who are you that you can stock an empty sea with fish? I mean, what is this? And so Paul said to me, so it's the nets. They spend 80-90% of their time building the nets. So he said, you're talking to guys who fish with nets about fishing. When he said, I want you to fish for people, they would have thought about grabbing people in nets. Do you follow? And he's just a musician, this Coleman guy. What does he know? He said, so I started to ask myself, what are the nets? If the fishermen's nets are strong and the holes aren't too big, they'll catch whatever is in their way. And so he said, I started to think about the church. I started to think that the nets, all the bits that we've got to make nice and strong, are actually all the friendships that we build between Christians and non-Christians alike. Now follow this line of thinking, because I love it. If I choose to be the best darn friend people in my church have ever had, I will love them, give them what they want, pray for them, serve them. If I choose right now, at a little church of 30 people, and I say, you 30 guys, you've never had a friend like me. I'll be there for you, resource you, listen to you, you name it. 100% commitment to you. And if I chose to be the best darn friend, 6, 8, 10, however many non-Christian friends I got have ever had, what is going to happen to these people? Sooner or later they're going to swim, are they not, into the nets of all these other friendships with Christians I've built. Is this making sense to you? That in effect, if we live holy lives and love each other like crazy, if we're praying, if we're socialising, if we're people of the word, if we love Jesus, we build those nets really strong between ourselves. When my non-Christian friends, to whom I have chosen to be the best darn friend I've ever had, are sooner or later going to get networked into this web of friendships. And now my non-Christian brother has got 20 Christian friends. He's going to come to my 21st, my wedding, my 40th. He's going to connect with a whole bunch of people. And they are going to love him like they've never been loved before. Sooner or later, now he's got 20 Christian friends. All of them are praying for him and loving him. And, keep listening, imagine if in that group of 20 or 30 Christian friends that he's now got, one or two or five of them happen to be the evangelists that we prayed God would raise up. One's looking over a beer with my brother late at night. Just let the gospel roll across the table into his heart. Is it possible that it could be that simple? Is it possible that all our buildings and our programs and all our accoutrements of church have actually made it harder than it should be? Or is it possible that you, your youth group, your leadership team, your church could decide right here and now, bugger it, which is an Old Testament expression, which means get it. I'm going to stick my head up out of the foxhole that I've been living in, and I'm going to choose to build those nets. I'm going to love you and you and you and you and you like you've never been loved before. And as I draw you into my life, I'm going to love others and draw them in. And this magnificent cocktail of lives swirling and interacting around each other, there are going to be some people in there who will allow the gospel to just pour out from you. Most people don't get converted these days by listening to the gospel. I get it. The light goes on. I'm saved. Most of them get converted by being drawn into a community, being loved, imbibing the gospel, being gospeled many times, and finally abandoning themselves to the irresistible grace of God. Do you follow? What would our churches look like if we chose to live in this organic relational way? It would be pandemonium. And our church leadership will do anything they can to ensure that we don't live like this. They're not evil people, don't get me wrong. But they have a whole system designed to support what we've already got. We've got to pay the bills. We've got to pay for the extension. We've got to pay for all the staff. We've got to keep it turning over the way it always has. But maybe some of us have enough artistic flair, enough creativity to say, I love you and I love what you're doing. But what we have to do is put our head up out of the foxhole, cut out across the open field and fashion much more radical alternative communities of faith than we've seen before. The early church combusted before they ever had a single public building, put anyone on staff, had anyone at the big table of power in our community. Why can't we dream of a radical alteration, going back to the beginning and recovering it for our future? It'll be risky, it'll be scary, and they'll give you a hard time. Which is why we need to be the untamed ones. Unleashing music and dance and painting and drama, unleashing a new revolution, a movement of people who look and act and love like Jesus. Do you follow? So how does that look? What kind of forms will that take? Tomorrow I want to actually tell you about a number of the churches I've seen around the world. Some of the clues. I don't want you to copy what they do, but I want you to see, oh, here's some waymarkers. Some radicals who've decided to step out and embrace something alternative.